Hey everybody, welcome to Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that dares you to think outside the box of convention and soar with the eagles in the free thought zone. That is my mission, and boy, I'm really honored to be able to bring you some of the true great minds, great thinkers, challenging the dogma. And of course, that will be what we're up to today as well. But before I introduce my guest today, I just want to tell you that I've got a lot in the cooker. I know a lot of you are anxious to hear about my programs for 2011. I'm getting them nailed down at the moment. There will be two Egypt programs this year because the response to my journey last year was unbelievable and I couldn't get everybody in. So keep an eye on my website, www.syrianrevelations.net, and you'll see the link Soul Quest Journeys at the banner at the bottom of the homepage. Check there and you will keep the updated information on the journeys, which will be very interesting this year, as always. Okay, and what was my other the thing that's in my craw, as they say? I just want to talk about this quickly. You know, a woman was walking down the street. A lady threw acid in her face, and this woman, who is burned with third-degree burns in her face, apparently had stopped at the store for no reason, no known reason. She said she never wore sunglasses. She stopped at the store to buy a pair of sunglasses. And so that because of those sunglasses, she hasn't gone blind. This woman who has been attacked in this brutal way, instead of lamenting and saying that she's a victim and she's despairing, said, "I'm so blessed that I stopped and got those glasses. I know that I'm being looked after." And I thought it's a really nice metaphor for us to remember the empty glass, the half-empty glass, the half-full glass paradigm. And when you look around you and think about what's lacking, just think about this woman, this beautiful woman whose face is scarred, whose vision of what had happened was a blessing that she had been guided to get those glasses. And let that be something for you to chew on before we move into our interview for the day. Right. You know that my passion, one of the many passions I have, is Egypt. We've been talking about Egypt quite a lot. I had the wonderful Christopher Dunn last week talking about his amazing new book, The Lost Technologies of Egypt. And I had Andrew Collins on some time ago. But we had, well, not that long ago, we had the most outrageous interference I think I've ever had on the show. And eventually the line dropped completely. We didn't get to finish our interview. So he's kind enough to be back today. Andrew Collins is a name that doesn't really need introduction. He is a writer with many hit books to his credit, from The Ashes of Angels, which shows that the watchers of the Book of Enoch were shamans responsible for the Neolithic Revolution, and that their homeland, the biblical Eden, was southeast Turkey, where archaeologists have recently found the oldest stone temple in the world. You may have seen some of those images. He wrote The Gods of Eden. He wrote Gateway to Atlantis, The Cygnus Mystery, and his most recent book, the one we'll be discussing again today, the one that seems to be stirring up a bunch of controversy, is entitled Beneath the Pyramids, Exploring These Caves, that everybody thinks they discovered first, but Andrew claims to have discovered. So, are you with us, Andrew?
I am. Hello, Patricia. Nice to be back.
Hello. Thank you. I'm so glad you came back on the show, and my apologies for all that interference we had last time. You know, I get a lot of interference.
I'm sure that it was all meant to be, which is obviously the reason why I'm back here now, to tell you all the wonderful things that have happened since that time.
All right, don't forget to keep your mouth away from the mouthpiece because we're getting that snapping sound already.
Okay.
All right, well, since we talked, which was just, I think a month or two ago, there's just such a buzz. We've got Zawi Hawass in his new documentary, Chasing Mummies, finally validating these caves. And so I'd like you to just start. Let's go back because truly your interview last time was so difficult because of the sound interference. So let's bring us up to date. What in the world is going on with these caves?
Well, I mean, I think to set the scene, that no caves have ever been found, and we're talking about natural caves, have ever been discovered at Giza before. But more importantly, no caves have ever been discovered in Egypt in connection with some kind of rock-cut tomb, which is the situation here. And we have discovered a whole entirely unknown cave system that has not been recorded in modern times. Now, the last it was ever mentioned, and I won't say in print because it was never even published, was in the memoirs of a British explorer by the name of Henry Salt, who wrote that in the year 1817, he entered catacombs to the west of the Great Pyramid and travelled for a distance of several hundred yards before coming across large chambers, and that his colleague, an Italian by the name of Giovanni Caviglia, travelled another 300 feet further before he gave up, having not found any gold or treasure. Now, as I said, this was in 1817. This was never published. And my colleague Nigel Skinner-Simpson managed to pin down exactly where the entrance was to the... getting some very bad interference here.
Yes, we are. And we've still got that snapping sound on your phone, so let's see if you can... Oh, I just don't know where it's coming from. Yeah. Well, let's just keep working through it.
Let's try to.
Do you have a cell phone around there?
It's coming back again, isn't it?
So. Yeah. Do you have a cell phone around the house?
No, I don't. I'm just trying to look around the room now for what might be causing it. So I shall try and take out any batteries on anything that might be causing it. So, right. But we'll continue on. But anyway, so. Carrying on now, in March 2008, myself, Nigel Skinner-Simpson, and my wife Sue, we returned back to Giza and went to a tomb which I'd already taken an interest in, and this was in the North Cliff at Giza, one that we referred to as the Tomb of the Birds, because the only other information we had about it was that around 150 years ago, the mummies of birds had been found in it. Nothing else. That was the only information that we knew about it. Nothing had been written about it in any book ever on the Giza Plateau. And we'd already been there in January 2007 looking around because I felt it was in some way connected with Giza's cave underworld. We never found anything at the time, but after Henry Salt's memoirs were finally made available in 2007, and Nigel worked out that the entrance to these catacombs were precisely in the area of this Tomb of the Birds, we went back there, and this time we were able to locate a small breach in the wall at the back of the tomb, somewhere that we'd missed the first time round, and this led into this huge natural cave chamber, which had been partly rock cut, to make it more sort of rectilinear in shape. But from this, there led various tunnels, one of which led for at least 300 to 350 feet into the rock, and a very treacherous, a very dangerous place full of bats, poisonous spiders, and all sorts of trials and tribulations relating to, rocks that had fallen, debris, pile-ups and things like this. And we navigated all of this. And as I say, we were able to penetrate for a distance well over 100 yards. Possibly up to about 120 yards, possibly more. And we finally stopped, and I say finally stopped. We did actually go back there on three further occasions, once more in March 2008, and then again twice in April 2008. And we stopped short of going through this stone tube, which is at ground level, which was just wide enough to squeeze, you know, a human body through. And the reason why we didn't go through is because, firstly, my wife was just about to try and get through it, and she heard some kind of animal within this hole beyond the actual tube itself. And the thought of encountering something that was large enough to displace rocks was something that we didn't want to go. Plus, in all honesty, we were not in the right psychological state of mind. Plus, we didn't have the correct breathing equipment with us. You know, to penetrate any deeper into this cave system, we knew we would have to have oxygen masks and whatever.
Well,
I think it's important to point out that this cave system has never been recorded. You know, there have been people since this whole story broke last year that have suggested that they've had information about these caves, but not one piece of evidence has come out to show that anybody was interested in these caves prior to us going in there. Now, clearly, you know, a few local people may have been aware of them. I mean, we encountered a tomb guardian who you know, sort of tended that area of the plateau, which is somewhere that that tourists or Egyptologists go to. I mean, it's just a very remote part. I mean, you know, obviously people need to be aware that everything's not in some small confined space, that it's spread out across a couple of miles. And that we went there and we encountered this tomb guardian, and he couldn't speak any English, but luckily my wife speaks Arabic, plus we were with a guide as well. And he was aware of the caves there, and he said that he would never go in them because, in his opinion, they were haunted by a great snake or serpent, which he called El Hanash. I subsequently found that there is some folklore stories that talk about this El Hanash being the guardian of what we would now call the Hall of Records, you know, beneath the plateau at Giza, and that the El Hanash guards a large crystal, and that this crystal, anybody that tries to approach it, this snake will blind them in both eyes, but one day somebody will come along and El Hanash will blind them only in one eye, and they will be allowed to, you know, to gain the knowledge and power that this great diamond, this crystal holds, and, you know, learn its wisdom, sort of thing. But this is something that is a folklore story that's general. It's not specifically about a spot on the plateau, but it was something I learned after this time. So the fact that the caves themselves were said to be haunted by El Hanash, by this local tomb guardian who never generally comes into contact with New Agers, I find was great. You know, it shows that there was some local tradition about this place.
Right, but let me interject something here. That is also, I think we brought this up last time you were on. Of course, the great snake is also the symbol of the guardian of the Duat.
Absolutely.
About whether the caves were the physical representation of the Duat.
Absolutely. I mean, in the Duat, which was basically seen as two things. It was seen as an underground cave system through which the souls of the departed would have to navigate on their way to an afterlife amongst the stars. But the Duat was also associated with the sky as well. It was possibly associated with the Milky Way and its position in the northern part of the sky, in the proximity of the circumpolar stars, the stars that revolve around the north celestial pole. And so it was like as above, so below. There was like a starry Duat and there was like a terrestrial duat. And the
okay, hold on a minute. I've got to interrupt you because I'm getting signs from some of my listeners that are tuning out because this sound is driving them crazy. So right. We're going to see what we can do to adjust this problem. It's apparently, my producer's saying if you whisper, if you take your voice further away from the the speaker of the phone and then almost whisper, he'll turn up your volume and that might do it.
Okay. Right. Well, okay. Well, this is slightly far away now. How's that?
It's much, much better. Can you remember to keep the distance?
Okay. I'll try and do that.
All right. Great. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I didn't realize just how much of a controversy the finding of these caves would be, because something like this is quite major, in the sense that how could anybody have missed something as important as this so close to the Great Pyramid? When I say close, I mean it is several hundred yards away, but I mean, when you're talking about the Great Pyramid, I mean it's still very close. And obviously it's a similar distance away from the other two pyramids as well, you know, which are easily accessible from the tomb that allows you access into the caves. But, I mean, to me, what's more important is, you know, what did this cave system represent to the ancient Egyptians? Well, we know that it was used as a bird necropolis. In that the mummies of birds were interred in here. Now, if that's correct, it would suggest that the site was associated with some kind of god or goddess in the form of a bird, some kind of bird deity. And exactly which one this is will depend on what evidence is now uncovered to tell us the type of birds and bird mummies that were placed there. We haven't got that information yet, because the only information, the tiny amount of information we have relating to these burials is from 150 years ago, and they don't state what type of birds were actually discovered here.
I suppose any link between this and the bird burials that they found near Abydos?
I don't know, is the honest answer. I mean, you know, it all depends on what type, what species of bird is involved. It could be a raptor, you know, a hawk, a falcon, possibly even eagle, or it could be an ibis, which I think is probably more likely. And ibises are symbols of the god Thoth.
Right.
Who obviously in the Roman times, the Greek and Roman times, was referred to as Hermes.
Right.
And I think it's much more likely that it's going to be a cult of Thoth Hermes. The reason I say that is that there was a tradition that the tomb of Hermes is actually to be found on the plateau at Giza. It was described as a cave, and it was said to be in the proximity of the second pyramid. The reason why that's significant to the cave discovery is that we have a radar satellite image taken from high above the ground by a German satellite on frequencies which do not use visible light that seem to show the position of the caves that have been explored so far. And what's interesting is that this is shown in the form of like a long shadow line. That shadow line is seen to continue from the area of the caves, curving all the way round to the second pyramid. Now, what does this show? It might show the caves, but I think more likely is that the caves are following the course of what's known as fault lines, which are fractures in the rock caused by the weakness in the rock and the movement of the rocks on the actual plateau. And the orientation of the plateau is northwest to southeast. And the fact that these shadow lines are following that same orientation from the area of the caves towards the second pyramid suggests to me that what we are seeing is evidence of underground faulting. And where you have faulting, you have caves, because water, which is the thing that's actually caused the caves to exist, flows through the lines of least resistance, and that's generally always fault lines or subsurface faulting of this kind. So I think there is a possibility that those caves do continue all the way to the second pyramid.
Well, let me interject something here, and that is that, yeah, of course, the great Hakim, who I was honored to know and spend time with, described a series of tunnels that he used to... He told me that he climbed into a tunnel at Saqqara and came out at the plateau. So, of course, he's not here to respond to that comment, but I do pretty much believe that the whole area is riddled with man-made tunnels. So how does this correspond? I mean, your idea of these caves running through versus man-made tunnels that were built by the ancient Egyptians.
Well, firstly, I've every respect for the teachings of Hakim, who I had a lot of time for, met him on various occasions, and I am aware of the stories of a tunnel system going from Giza to Saqqara, which would be a distance of, I believe, probably between about 12 and 15 miles. I have not seen any hard evidence for the existence of these man-made tunnels, and I would be very happy to receive any information relating to the entrance and exit of these places. If anybody can point me to a spot on the plateau at Giza, we can investigate this and we can find out what is known about this site, not just from modern excavations, but from travellers' accounts of the 18th, the 19th century, which tell us an awful lot that is not recorded in modern times. Plus also, obviously, the same for Saqqara. If it can be shown where these tunnels come out, then we can investigate those and see whether they do go for that type of distance.
But what I don't really think the Department of Antiquities is going to let people crawl around in the tunnel.
No, but, you know, you don't need to, because quite clearly, if they do exist, people will have mentioned them at some point in the past, and you can gradually build up a picture that the Egyptologists may well have missed themselves. This, of course, is what we did to actually find the caves at Giza. You know, we managed to piece together evidence that had been totally overlooked by the Egyptologists, you know, and achieve something which they had not been able to do, and that was realize that there was a cave system at Giza and actually go out and find it.
All right, now here's a question for you that I'm sure a lot of people are curious about. You left up in the story where there was this very narrow tube that would have taken you further in, and the sound of some beastly, creepy crawler justifiably stopped you. Did this tubular structure look man-made at all?
No, it was created by the course of water, what the geologists call pluvial action. The caves would have been made by water tens of thousands or maybe even hundreds of thousands of years ago. But as far as this stone tube is concerned, it's been a huge mystery as to what lays beyond this. I have speculated myself that there may well be some kind of cavity or maybe another deeper cave chamber beyond it. One of the team from Chasing Mummies actually explored the tube, got stuck in it, and had to come out feet first. And he claimed that it doesn't go anywhere. Now, he could be correct, although our pictures seem to suggest that there is a small cavity at least beyond that tube, which I would like to have more knowledge of as to whether it does or doesn't go anywhere. They could be right. It may well be that this cave system has a total length of probably around 300 to 350 feet. It is isolated, and it doesn't go to the any of the other pyramids. That is a possibility. But as I said, there are various pieces of evidence that suggest that somewhere in those caves is a point of entry into a deeper part of a complex. This, from the radar satellite imagery, seems to suggest that the caves continue on, plus the fact we have Henry Salt's own account, which seems to suggest that he went for a distance of several hundred yards. Those are his exact words. Now, there could be some confusion as to what he actually meant by going several hundred yards, but this is something that we're still trying to analyze and try and understand in the light of the broadcast of Chasing Mummies over the last, well, I say the last few days. I mean, it was actually broadcast on Wednesday night on the History Channel in the USA. And since that time, we've been trying to look and analyze the footage and to see exactly what's going on here. So that's still a mystery. I mean, my personal belief is that the caves do continue in some manner. However, important...
Andrew, please, try again with the holding the phone group further from you, because you're zapping out here.
Okay.
See, remember to do that, you come in much clearer.
Okay. Now, the important part about Chasing Mummies is that Zahi Hawass is forced to admit, actually in front of the cameras, and this was broadcast, that there is a natural cave system here. And prior to this time, his public statement on the whole affair was that there were no caves, there's no cave complex at Giza. This is something that you'll find even to this day on his own website. And for that reason, this is quite a huge admission. So now his opinion is that the area of the tomb is obviously rock cut and thus human made. But beyond that is a vast natural cave system. And that during the late dynastic period and in Roman times, this was used as a animal necropolis, but to be honest, it would be better described as a bird necropolis, because that's the information that we have as to its past usage. If it was a bird necropolis, then the chances are that it was sacred to a god or goddess connected with a bird. I believe probably the most likely deity associated with this site was Thoth, Hermes. And that the existence of these caves is associated with the belief that the tomb of Hermes was in that general area somewhere.
But didn't we think that this, I mean, I've always believed that we would discover this tomb at Saqqara.
You're talking about the tomb of Imhotep, I believe.
No, I've heard always that we would expect Thoth's burial grounds to be at Saqqara.
No, definitely not. The reason why Thoth is associated with Saqqara is because of Imhotep. Imhotep was the architect for the pyramid of Djoser, the step pyramid, which was built during the third dynasty of Egyptian history, approximately around 2675 BC. And in later times, Imhotep was deified and became associated with the cult of two separate gods. One was Asclepius, whose obvious symbol is the wand with the snake going round. He's the god of medicine, but also Asclepius was also considered to be a son of Thoth Hermes. So in other words, Imhotep was seen as either a son or an incarnation of Thoth, and it's for this reason why Thoth and the worship of Thoth became connected with the area of Saqqara. Thoth himself was connected with his cult centre, which was Hermopolis, which was in central Egypt. Plus, his cult was also associated with Akhmin, which is another centre in central Egypt, where some have suggested that his tomb was. But, you know, there are conflicting traditions, of course. You know, I mean, each different Egyptian cult centre had their own mythology, their own beliefs, their own ideas, their own religion. So, and each of those generally conflicted with other rival cult centres. But there's definitely a strong tradition to do with Thoth Hermes at Giza.
We seem to have these conflicting cults today in our modern times with people having their very strong opinions about understanding and knowing what really came down in ancient Egypt. And you seem to be in the middle of that quite a lot. And many of us are. I mean, you know, it's like Egypt continues to be in our face. And all of the things that are being discovered now are it's amazing that there's so much coming to the foreground. Of course, right in timing with the 2012 paradigm. But there are just a number of exciting new things happening in Egypt, notwithstanding the fact that it really does appear that the antiquities people want to control the information as much as possible and own it as much as possible, which is one of the reasons why you're in the middle of all these things, because you claim to have discovered these caves.
Yeah, well, I don't claim now. I mean, I think that it's just generally accepted because...
There are people who do not accept it and say that they're the ones that discovered it and you're a fraud.
Well, that's always going to happen, isn't it? I mean, you make any big discovery, and if people have been looking for something similar for years, there's certainly going to be some personal rivalry, personal jealousy, and, you know, people are going to say, well, I knew about those caves all along, or words to that effect. You know, to try and alter the importance of that discovery. And it's going to happen, but in a way, it really doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, so I was going to say, it's not who discovered it that matters, although obviously it's a wonderful...
You know, it really doesn't matter. And also, I mean, on television this week, on a reality TV show, you had Zoe Hawass discovering the caves now. So, you know, it's gone past that point of personal discovery now. I mean, clearly, you know, the whole story behind us finding the caves is in the book Beneath the Pyramids. That was published last year. And as I said earlier on, I have not found one shred of evidence that anybody was onto those caves before we got into them in March 2008. Not one piece of evidence anywhere. You know, and I mean, over the years, I must have read dozens, if not hundreds of books about the pyramids and Egypt and whatever. Not one of them talks about those caves. They talk generally about caves, rumours, stories, legends, folklore, going all the way back to dynastic times about caves at Giza. But these are the first ones that have ever actually been discovered. And this is a huge cave system, and I think what we should be doing now is trying to say, well, what was the importance of these caves to the pilgrims that came to the plateau, to the dynastic Egyptians? You know, was this the site of the, of seen as the site of the tomb of Hermes? Is this why it became a bird necropolis in honor of his presence?
And also you have, you know, implied, unless I misread you, that it may very well be a way into the Hall of Records from what you said about the guardian and the snake story.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, are we ever going to find the Hall of Records? It's possible. But I think what is important in our time is the fact that that search continues and that we continue to have hope that our, that the fruits of our researches are going to lead to some kind of conclusion eventually. But of course, it's like the search for the Holy Grail. I mean, it's one of these things that the search is probably more important than the actual finding of the final item. And this could well be the case. I mean, I was inspired by the search for the Hall of Records. It's something I've been interested in for the last 30, 35 years. And so this is the culmination of my own passion and interest in the subject over that period. You know, if I hadn't have listened to psychics, if I had not read Edgar Cayce books, I would never have discovered those caves.
So then you do, as much as you are a historian and a scientist, you do embrace the esoteric wisdom as well.
Of course, very much so. It's very, very important to me. And but the important thing to emphasize, though, is that I keep them apart. You have to look at hard fact and work with that, and then you have to work with the more emotive, psychic side of things, but you must keep them apart, because a psychic says, you know, that there might be some kind of Atlantean crystal existing beneath Giza doesn't mean that it's there. You have to keep that as something of the heart, you know, unless it is proved the case. You can believe it, but you can't state that it's there as proof or hard evidence until you have firm evidence of that fact. You know, and that's, you know, you have to keep the two sides of the brain separate. I recall I was talking about this in our last interview, probably just at the point that I think we lost contact through so much noise. But it is true. I mean, you know, you can believe what you like about what's beneath the plateau at Giza, and it may well be true. I encourage psychics to contact me with their dreams and their visions about what they believe is at Giza, because somewhere out there, somebody might have a vital piece of information, maybe to do with another entry point into the case system.
Well, how about the Osiris shaft, which I have been in?
Well, the Osiris shaft is an interesting story, one that started in the 1930s with the work of Dr. Salim Hassan, who was a Egyptologist who had the concession to work in that area. He cleared away the causeway that linked the Second Pyramid with the Sphinx area, found a tunnel going through the causeway, and as he was clearing that, he uncovered the entrance into this series of three levels, which ended with a lower level, which was partly filled with water, a raised area in the middle, four columns, which were around the edge of this island, and a sunken sarcophagus in the middle. Now, this was discovered in the 1930s. It was written up by Salim Hassan back at that time, But of course, it was then forgotten until the 1990s when Boris Said, a television producer who'd worked extensively in the field of Egypt and Egyptological research, started to relook at this, what was known then as the water shaft, and they tried to get a TV documentary made about it. That didn't happen. But in 1998, the year that Edgar Cayce had predicted that something major was going to happen in connection with the Hall of Records, Dr. Zahi Hawass announced the discovery of the Osiris shaft, which was obviously this updated name for the water shaft. And he said that this was a symbolic place of interment for the god Osiris, and that it was seen as that as it was created. And he's written articles, he's talked extensively about this. There's a whole blog about it on his website. So he, you know, this is something that he was able to claim for himself back in 1998. And in many ways, he's doing the same thing now with the case system. But as far as the Osiris shaft is concerned, there isn't any hard evidence that it connects with any kind of cave system. There is a cavity in the northwest corner of the deepest level, and Dr. Hawass has sent up a small boy, and there's a picture of this child trying to make this journey on his website, and he was able to get just a very short distance, I mean, you know, 10, 15 feet before having to come back. It might have been longer than that, but it was no further than that. And clearly, if a child could not get down this natural cavity, nobody else was going to be able to do it.
If that's a true story.
Yeah, no, that's the true story.
I mean, my
colleague Nigel Skinner-Simpson has followed every step of discovery relating to the Osiris shaft, and Anna's been down there and has examined all of this, and that's it really. I mean, anybody that tries to tell you more, I think you've just got to say to them, please present us with the evidence, because there isn't any evidence of anything else happening in connection with the Osiris shaft.
Well, but the, you know, playing the devil's advocate, there will be people who say the same thing about your discoveries in the caves.
I mean, as far as the discoveries in the caves, I mean, they were on television this week. You know, what we saw, everybody else can now see. And although I would like to keep the dream alive that there is some entrance that will take us into a deeper part of the cave system, maybe there isn't. Maybe what has been discovered by us and obviously has now been explored by Dr. Hawass and the Chasing Mummies team is all there is to see. I don't know. If that is the case, I will accept that. But I think as far as rumours and stories are concerned, you know, that they have to remain that unless anybody can present good evidence.
On the other hand, let's not forget that, you know, the existence of the cage, you've mentioned water several times, and that in itself is a very important discovery.
I'd like to think so, yeah.
You keep mentioning it, it had to be water. It's like, hello, this is one of the most important things that's coming out of your discovery as far as I'm concerned, because we've got Robert Schock proving to me at least, the water levels that existed, the watermarks that are on the Great Sphinx.
Yeah.
And so that aspect of this discovery is very important.
Oh, God, of course. If the caves had been accessible at the time of the Pyramid Age, which I think is likely, then these would have been seen as symbolically extremely important, and they may tell us why the pyramids were placed there in the first place.
So what does the future hold here as far as the exploration of these caves? What do you think? I mean, what's Hawass doing, and what do you think?
They have been cemented shut with a metal gate. a metal gate that will only be removed using a very large sledgehammer. And nobody is going in those caves anytime soon. They have been completely sealed shut. Now, I did ask Dr. Hawass to put a gate on the front of them. And the reason for that was because, firstly, there is a whole ecosystem of bats, insects, spiders, and God knows what else.
And things that go bump in the night.
Things that go bump in the night, indeed. The things that, that you're supposed to encounter in the do-out, of course. Now, so that was important. Plus, it was important that once knowledge of their whereabouts became known, that people did not go in there, A, to plunder any untouched archaeology, and B, not to plant things. And this is important because, you know, certain unscrupulous people could have gone in there, buried crystals, buried artifacts, buried anything which would have completely confused any future archaeology at the site. And this was also quite important because, you know, that there have been certain claims by people that followed us into those caves that they were full of gold and treasure. This has now been shown to be completely false from, obviously, the Chasing Mummies footage this week. If the place had been full of gold and treasure, I think that Dr. Hawass and his team would have discovered at least one item of it, and they didn't find anything. Certainly, there was no indication that they found anything there. We never saw anything like that when we were there.
You never really know what they're discovering because it's only what they're telling us that they're discovering, right?
Well, that's true, but we can only work with what information we've got. I am in touch with one of the team from Chasing Mummies, and he's been, you know, quite honest with me about the events. This is one of the reasons why I knew that it was going to be screened in the first place. So, you know, I will continue to ask questions. I mean, clearly, there must be a lot of footage that was not broadcast this week on the History Channel. I want to try and see if I can find out more about that. I need to ask the correct questions, not just to Hawass, but also the other consulting archaeologists that were involved with the series, because we need to learn much more. I mean, you know, virtually nothing was said about the caves whilst they were actually being shown on television. It was only Hawass trying to disprove us pyramidiots, as he called us, disprove the fact that the caves go all the way to the pyramids. And he did that to his satisfaction. But I'm afraid that anybody else looking at that television and saying, well, yeah, but hold on, there's a huge great cave system here. Please tell us something about that. Nothing was said about that, other than the suggestion by Hawass that this was used at some point as an animal necropolis. That's the only words of wisdom he basically said about it.
Well, now that you've convinced him to seal it off, how are you going to get back in?
Well, I mean, clearly, the idea was not to get them to seal it off. The idea was to put a swing gate on it, which could be locked up, like virtually every other tomb on the plateau, and that future research could be continued there. But in his wisdom, he decided to cement it into place so that nobody can go in there now. I am sure that at some future date, that gate will be removed and that more work will go on there. But unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen in the short term. At the moment, the dust has to settle. At the moment, everything is up in the air. I think people watched that program this week and wondered what the hell was going on. And I think it will be something, a slow burner. And over time, and it could even take years now, there'll be more and more interest in them to try and understand what those caves meant to the pyramid builders, the dynastic, you know, the whole dynastic times, you know, the ancient Egyptians, and of course what they meant to the Romans, the Greeks, and the pilgrims that came from all over the Middle East to Egypt during Arab times. You know, if they were open then, how were they seeing them? What did they interpret them as? Yeah, these are the questions which we need to ask now.
All right. Well, these are the questions you're going to have to leave us with because we're out of time already. So for those psychics that want to call, contact Andrew and give your insights to him. What is the place where they can find you?
Right. Okay. AndrewCollins.com. If people can come to me, I'll happily correspond. Plus, I'm on Facebook. Plus, obviously, you know, the full story of the discovery of the caves is in the book Beneath the Pyramids, which you can get from Amazon, you know, or any online store.
I got it in a bookstore, too, so it's available in the bookstores, too. I'm going to say goodbye to Andrew so that I've got a few more minutes to talk to you about my upcoming Egypt trips. But before I do, Andrew, when will you be back in Egypt?
November, I think, is what's on the cards at the moment.
Okay.
So,
well, let's
see,
you know,
what reception we get.
I'm planning to drop over to in November too, and I'd love to meet up with you there.
Well, that could be possible.
All righty. You've been listening to Andrew Collins. The book is Beneath the Pyramids. Woo! What about this? Let me know what you think about this. Send me your emails. And let's have a dialogue about that. Thank you so much, Andrew.
It's my pleasure. I'll speak to you again soon.
Speak again soon, for sure.
Okay.
Take good care.
All
right, everybody. Before I sign out, I want you to know again, I've got these two trips coming up to Egypt. Oh, the first one is in February. The dates are about the 2nd to the 9th, about the 3rd or 4th of February to the 19th. And I'm extending to Jordan, to Petra, to experience that amazing temple in the rocks, in the Rocky Mountains. This trip will be different than some of my others because we'll be going to Tel Amarna, the land of Akhenaten, where he built his temples to Aten, the one god, and broke away from the traditions in Egypt of the priesthood and the tradition of the many god pantheon. So, please check my site again if you want to be on that trip. Last year, I had 75 people on the trip and a wait list for that. So they do sell out rather quickly. www.syrianrevelations.net. Go to my Sacred Journey site. Take a look. If you're interested in any of these journeys, I need for you to write me and ask me to put on a priority mailing list so you've got a first chance at signing up before the trips fill up. All right, my time is over already. Next week I've got a very interesting guy, Paul Brockton. He's going to be talking about all kinds of conspiracy things, what's happening with the economy, gold and silver. The man is a powerhouse of information, and I think it's time for us to be talking about what to do in these coming times of economic upheaval. Not that it's not already in upheaval, but just insights into what you can do to balance it out for yourself. And with that, I'm going to leave you with that thought. Balance is what we're after, and that is what we anticipate we will create every day of our lives when we are outside of the matrix, soaring in the free thought zone, open to new ideas, listening to others, trusting that everybody's opinion matters. And that's how we create the reality. Ciao, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. Have a wonderful day. Oh, and a great holiday. Take care.